Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our theme for this show is Grapevine. We're hearing stories of rumors, pranks, and scandals.
We'll kick off the show with a story from a recognizable Anchorage resident. Jeff Landfield has engaged in a variety of pursuits since he moved to Alaska in 2004.
These include driving a cab, working as a doorman at the Captain Cook Hotel, and doing sales in the IT industry. But perhaps he's best known for his involvement in Alaska politics.
4 years ago, I ran for the state senate because I was really worried about our state's fiscal situation. And it was my first time in politics, and I was really excited. And it didn't work out, but I got 45%. I had very little money, and I really enjoyed it. And I knew I was going to, you know, stay involved in politics and maybe run again and maybe stay involved in public life. So after that period of time, 4 years ago, you know, I go to Vegas. I'm 31 now. I was 28 at the time. And, you know, we all have cell phones, cameras, Facebook nowadays, and I'd go there and with my friends, and one day I had like an epiphany, because you guys might know me, you've heard of me, I wear a Speedo or a Mankini or whatever it is, and I like to do that. So one day I said, well, if I'm going to be doing this, everybody's taking a picture, so I may as well just put it out there myself. So I started posting these pictures of me and my Speedo or my Mankini with girls, and these girls, I didn't ask them, they'd always come to me, can we get a picture with you, can we get a picture with you? And anybody who's ever been to Vegas knows I like to have a good time there. So throughout this period of time, a couple years, I knew I wanted to be more involved in public life. So I started to kind of investigate what was out there as far as, you know, boards and commissions. And if you guys don't know, there's hundreds of state boards and commissions. And the governor appoints people to these boards and commissions. And some are pretty high profile, you know, the Board of Fish, the Board of Game, the Parole Board. And then some of them are kind of like, you know, the Massage Board or whatever. So I started to investigate that, but at the time, Governor Sean Parnell was governor, and I was pretty critical of his fiscal policies, and I was pretty much told after I applied a couple times, you're not going to be appointed to a board or commission by Governor Parnell. So I said, all right, well, whatever, it's not going to happen. So a couple years ago, you know, Bill Walker runs for governor with Byron Merlot. I get really excited. I help out. I wanted to see him do well, and I kind of was involved in helping out with the campaign a little bit, and he won. And after he won, I said, geez, maybe I can get on one of these boards and commissions now, because now it's a governor that might want to appoint me. So I applied, I put in my resume, I knew some people that were in his you know, his administration, and when you apply, they make you list, you know, 5 or 10 boards and commissions you're interested in. And I put, you know, Alcohol Beverage Control Board, I put a couple other ones, Alaska Energy Authority, and that was that. So a couple, after I applied, a couple weeks later, I get an email, I wake up in the morning, and it said, congratulations, you've been appointed to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. And I said, what the f*** is that? So the first thing I do is Google this, and it's 9 people, 3 judges, 3 lawyers, and 3 public members. And I'll be honest, I thought that was kind of a weird one to put me on. 4 years ago when I ran against Liesl McGuire. And the way this works, the governor appoints you, but the legislature has to confirm you. And, you know, Judicial Conduct, Liesl McGuire is the chair of the Judiciary Committee, so it's going to her committee. And I said, wow, that's interesting. And I was pretty excited about it. And I called up the people that the boards and commissions folks and said, hey, I'm really excited about this. Just so you know, I told you guys I was going to run again. And I told you guys I ran against Liesl. And they said, oh, no big deal. Don't worry about it. The next day, a pretty well-known political reporter puts out a tweet, who's bringing popcorn to Jeff Landfield's confirmation hearing, you know, before the Judiciary Committee with Senator McGuire. And I was pretty pumped about it. So, you know, a couple days goes by and I get a call back from the boards and commissions lady and says, hey, you know, this is a big problem. We didn't think it was going to be a big deal. You're going to have to step down. And I go, why? What's the problem? And they go, well, your pictures. And I go, what, the ones on Facebook? You guys know about those pictures. I told you guys about those. They're in secret. And I said, I don't want to, you guys, it was already announced. It was already read through the journal. People knew about it. And it was already kind of out there. And I didn't want to be bullied and step down. And I said, look, if the governor wants me to step down, I'll step down. But he didn't even know about it yet, because the way this works, there's hundreds of people who get appointed or more, and the governor only signs off on it at the end. So I said, I'm going to think about it, but I don't want to step down right now. And I made some calls to some people and who were on the committee, and they said, yeah, no big deal, man. Just do whatever you want. And So that same day, I get a call from my buddy who's in Juneau. He's a staffer, and he goes, dude, what are you doing right now? And I said, I'm nothing. I'm at work. He goes, dude, there is pictures of you all over the Capitol in your Speedo, like everywhere. Like, people are like, who is this guy? Wow, what's going on? And so we all know what happened with that, right? So I got another call back and said, you're really gonna have to step down. And I said, look, let me think about it over the weekend. I don't want to necessarily do that because I don't want to be bullied. So a little bit later, I said, I'm gonna think about it over the weekend. I get a call back saying, you're off the commission. It's way above us. It's been decided that you're gonna be taken off. And I said, all right, well, I just would advise you guys to think, I would think this is gonna be a big story if you guys do this, but whatever. And I didn't think it was gonna be as big as it got. So next week I get a call from a reporter saying, when's your confirmation hearing? And I go, I don't know, ask Senator McGuire, ask the governor, I have no idea. And then the whole thing blew up. I mean, it got to be ADN got a hold, because it was announced in the press release from the governor that, you know, they said I was disrespectful and they called me a misogynist and they said all these really mean things about me that they had to kind of say to justify their position. So everything starts going, it starts to trend on Twitter as SpeedoGate, hashtag SpeedoGate. And, you know, all the people that were, and so some of the comments were great. You know, some of the comments in some of the articles were like, 30, dude acts like he's 20, looks like he's 50. He really needs to slow down. There's a bunch. So I, you know, pretty much the whole thing devolved within a couple days. It was an article in Huffington Post. And the big question was, what did he do? Because a lot of people who are fully clothed in politics do a lot of shady things. And, you know, this guy's pretty transparent. I mean, there's no transparency issues with this guy. So you know, that was kind of that. And I knew I was going to keep in politics and I wanted to stay involved. And I said I was going to run again. And everybody said, this guy's dead. He's all washed up. And as you guys know, I just ran again. And I did lose, but I had a good time with it. And one of the funniest stories, people don't really care about my Speedo. They care about the state's fiscal problems. But one lady, she was an older lady, probably in her 60s, and I knock on her door, and she goes, aren't you that young man who wears those European swimsuits in the newspaper? And I said, yeah, that's me. And she was really nice, and maybe she voted for me. I have no idea. But, you know, I want to close the story with the commission I was put on, the Commission on Judicial Conduct that I was taken off of, whoever they replaced me with recently quit. So there's an opening on the Commission for Judicial Conduct. And, you know, I recently applied, and I ain't crossed my fingers, but we'll see what happens. Thank you guys very much.
That was Jeff Landfield, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme is Grapevine, stories of rumors, pranks, and scandals.
Now we'll hear from 11-year Alaska resident Nick McMillan, who's made some questionable decisions when it comes to even his most intimate and long-lasting friendships. This story is a great example of what I'm talking about.
Here's Nick on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
I met Anna in the third grade. It was 1985. I had just moved to a new town with my family, and she was born and raised there. We lived one street from each other, rode the same bus. We started dating in seventh grade. I think we called it going out. And by eighth grade, we were pretty much best friends. By ninth grade, I came out to her. She basically shrugged her shoulders and said, yeah, I know. It was the easiest coming out I've ever had to do. You know, as years went on, we were the prom king and queen. We lived together our first year of college. And eventually, we started making our own paths. And she moved to Boston. I moved up here to Anchorage. And so basically, we, after what, 31 years of friendship, we talk on the phone probably 5, maybe 10 times a week. That's about our average. That's how we keep the friendship alive. So about 7 years ago, she tells me that she has a crush on this guy. And I get really excited because she doesn't have crushes very often. You know, for most of the 38 years of our lives, we were pretty much single or dated here and there. But she tells me about him. His name is Alexi. He used to be an Italian soccer player. he and his wife and kids live in Boston now, and they work together. And apparently, he's really hot. So I actually meet him. You know, I go back to Boston quite a bit to visit, and I meet him. He's engaging. He's funny. He's nice. He is very good looking. I found out he was also an underwear model. So now I want to marry him. And so, yeah, you know, he's just the kind of guy that you just, I don't know, you love whether you like him or not. And so maybe about 2 years ago then, well, they actually, Alexi and Anna and then a couple of other friends, they create this pretty close group of friends. And about 2 years ago, Anna tells me that Alexi is going to get a divorce. And he's been really leaning on his friend group for help during this time. And he has asked Anna if he can stay at her place for a little while he's going through this divorce. And if you know Anna, she's a classy lady. She is a shoulder to cry on. She helps him throughout this process. I am not a classy lady. I would figure out basically how to do the bend and snap while we were watching soccer. Or I would accidentally give him a washcloth instead of a real towel when it's shower time. Did I mention he's an underwear model? So I get excited. I'm like, well, that's kind of cool. And she's just like, no, it is what it is. You know, she still has a crush on him, whatever. So then maybe a couple weeks later, she tells me we slept together. I just want to know how good of a kisser he is and what the muscles on his back feel like. But she does not kiss and tell like I would. So I get very little detail, but I'm excited for her. And then I would say maybe a couple weeks later, she's late. She's pregnant. I don't know what to do. I mean, are you going to tell Alexi? I don't know. Are you gonna keep the baby? I don't know. Do you want me to move to Boston and help you raise this child? I don't know. Do you want to move to Alaska? No. So I'm in a whirlwind. I am excited for her. I'm anxious. I'm nervous. I mean, this is my best friend, and I want to raise supermodel Italian babies with her. So another couple weeks go by, and so she tells me not much again. I keep asking her all these questions, like, how far along are you? Have you gone to the doctor? Does Alexi know? Like, tell me more. And she's just very ho-hum, and she basically says, I ask her again, what are you going to do? And she says, nothing. What? Nothing. I'm like, what do you mean nothing? What do you mean? She says, I'm not going to do anything. I was like, what? I'm stunned. I'm confused. I don't understand. What are you talking about? But I can feel her fist clenching on the other end of the line, and she's getting ready to raise it and pump it in the air as she tells me, April Fools. I'm laughing now, but I was not then. I still wanted to know what back muscles felt like. I was stunned. I had no idea what she was talking about. And she basically said, I am finally getting you back for that April Fool's joke you played on me so many years ago. So now I'm confused and I have no memory. Because I don't know what I did. And she is so happy with herself that she finally got me back. And I am so upset that she did not sleep with Alexi. And she basically, I don't know, what did I tell you? What did I do? What was the April Fool's joke that I told you? And so she says, remember when we lived in Seattle and you called me up one night, and she's like, I was asleep, I was in my pajamas, and you said, I need to meet you out, I really have to tell you something, like it's important, so let's go grab a beer. we go grab a beer, and I take her on this 15-minute journey of, oh, I'm embarrassed to even say this because I was so young and dumb. I told her I was HIV positive. I had just had a test that day, and I thought that would be funny. I thought, I don't know what it was. And I basically took her through 15 minutes of agony, and she asked me what I was gonna do, and I said, nothing. I said, April Fools. So my 15 minutes and her 15 years, she finally got me back. And so basically the only thing I know to this day is, if you're not a classy lady, don't mess with a classy lady.
That was Nick McMillan, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. We're hearing true stories told by Alaskans.
Marcia Wakeland is a living Alaskan cliché. She came up here for 1 year and wound up staying for 41. She's also an awesome listener. In fact, she's the founder of The Listening Post in Anchorage. At The Listening Post, stories of the community are heard and respected at the Transit Center, Brother Francis Shelter, and Beans Cafe, and soon the Mountain View and Lusac Libraries.
Here, Marcia will take us back to some of her first experiences in Alaska.
It was January 1975 when I flew into Fairbanks, Alaska. I was 23 years old, and I was fresh out of physical therapy school, taking my first job treating outpatient injuries from the pipeline. And what I walked into was a boomtown. Fairbanks grew from 15,000 to 60,000 people 3 months just before I came. And there was literally no place to stay. People were staying in heated sheds and even chicken coops, trying to wait out and get a job and the big money on the pipeline. And the only reason that my girlfriend Sharon and I got a place to stay was the fact that the doc we worked with was treating the woman that owned the whole city block right across the street with a couple apartment houses on it. And he told her, if you don't give these girls a place to stay, I'm not going to treat you anymore. She wasn't happy about that. And her name was Bea Steen. And the rumor was that she was the former madam of Fairbanks, that she ran a boarding house with benefits. And that's how she'd gotten all her money. When we met Bea, we didn't believe it at all. We thought Doc was just teasing us, because she was this heavyset woman with swollen ankles, gray hair back in a bun, married to a kind of quiet guy. But she was tough. And she said, you know, girls, I live in that penthouse apartment up there. I can see everything you do, and you're not going to get away with a thing. And she said, by the way, no one's ever gotten their deposit back from me, ever. No one can pass my white glove test. And then she slammed the door. That was our introduction. Well, within a week, she summoned us up to the penthouse apartment. And Sharon and I went, oh, no, what have we done wrong already? So we get up to her apartment. She opens the door and says, oh, it's you. Oh, come in. Sits us in these big, overstuffed lounge chairs and was kind of upset with us because we didn't take all the candy she kept passing us in all these candy bowls. And finally she said, well, what is it? Where are you girls from? And so we told her we were Midwest Iowa farm girls. That we'd grown up in small towns and went to the university just 80 miles away. You know, Sharon and I had grown up in the culture that you don't get into do anything to embarrass your family, that you do what you're told and you respect your elders. I could see somewhere along the line, I could see Bea made this decision, and she just stood up and she said, you girls come with me. You're just too nice. And I had never been accused of that before. So she took us back to what I can only describe as a boudoir. I remember walking in, it was like peach. It's kind of satin-colored wall coverings, and there was this big four-poster bed with silk and ribbons and lace and brocade pillows and this white rug. And before I could take this all in, she goes, yeah, girls, and look at that. So we look up to see this photo of this very shapely, beautiful woman, naked, looking over her shoulder at the camera, long hair coming down, and she says, that was me in my day. And Sharon and I looked at each other and went, it's true. The rumor's true. She was the madam of Fairbanks and one of the girls. And before we could quite take that all in, She started, I know she wanted to shock us some more. She opened up the drawers on this little chest of drawers and started taking out exotic lingerie and just kind of dangling them in front of us and then dropping them on the floor. But then she brought out the package that was wrapped in white tissue paper and slowly unwrapped it and says, "Do you know what these are?" Sharon and I didn't have a clue. She goes, "You don't, do you? They're tassels." Well, Sharon and I knew what corn tassels were, but we had no idea what she was talking about. And she said, "Well, girls, in my day, we didn't have those nice little tea parties where you sat around and drank tea out of the bone china. We drank whiskey, and all my girlfriends came over. You put them right here, girls, and then you get them swinging." Any notions of my Midwest propriety just went swinging in the breeze with that. And suddenly our interview was over, and she escorted us to the door, and she said, "Now, girls, you're going to the Floridor show this weekend. I'm going to get you tickets. It's an annual charity event by the Ox Club, and you'll be there." And of course we were. So we walk in, and we sit down at the table she's reserved for us, and I literally, within 5 seconds, I think there was 10 free drinks on our table. And we looked up to see that 10-to-1 ratio wasn't exaggerated. The show itself was great comedy acts, just all raunchy and bawdy. But the last one, the finale, was when these three very overweight women dressed only in flesh-colored bodysuits came out and with these sequined roses in all the right places. And they were dancing provocatively, and I might say quite professionally, to the music. And sure enough, the one on the right was our landlady, B. You know, we never were invited to the penthouse again. She never even talked about that day. And Sharon and I were like, "What was that all about?" But I'm sure she wanted to shock us and had fun with that. But I also think that she really saw these two naive, single Iowa farm girls and said, "Man, I need to give them an education. They're not going to make it in Fairbanks, Alaska." And you know, I thank her for that, because the next 2 years in Fairbanks were tough and gritty. You know, we had our purses nabbed a couple times, our car stolen, bullet holes through our window. We had our phone tapped because we had a jealous girlfriend. And we even had our patients coming with guards because the mafia were after them. So I have to thank her for the education that she did give us. You know, the last time that I saw B was when I was leaving town. We'd given up the apartment, and guess what? We got our deposit back, by the way. Iowa girls know how to clean. But she'd given us too much money back. And so I ran up to the penthouse with the excess, and I gave it to her. She grabbed it, and she said, "It's a damn good thing you gave this back, because I would have figured it out, and I would have had the troopers stop you before you got to the border." No thank you. No, like, "Goodbye. Nice to see you." But you know what B taught me, and what her, the first person who ever said, you know, and taught me, that it's good to just be who you are with no apologies. And once you've got that, you might as well flaunt it.
You just heard from Marcia Wakeland. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our next story comes from Trevor Millar.
Born and raised in Anchorage, Trevor has led a very active lifestyle with lots of adventure. But just 3 years ago, things changed for him dramatically. His story isn't a rumor, prank, or scandal like the rest of the stories on this hour of Arctic Entries. This story leads us to an account of another type of information passed through the grapevine.
A story begins on June 8th, 2013, hot summer day, and I'm healthy 30-year-old. I've gone to the lake with two college students that I've worked with for a number of years. And while I was with them, I was reflecting on what I had taught them, that God is good, and that Jesus was his natural expression on earth, and that I was to avoid sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Okay, I wasn't perfect at sex or rock and roll, okay? But that day, I was on an inner tube behind a jet ski, and when I jumped from one inner tube to the other, The loose rope somehow got around my neck. And when the jet ski took off, it went taut. And it dragged me underwater, and I grasped for the rope as it tore through the flesh of my neck. And I felt the panic of reaching for the surface. And I thought, it's over. And I finally made it to the surface and back to the dock. And when I got to the dock, I tried to talk. And it was only sounds and moans, no words. And air I was forcing in and out of my lungs. I couldn't breathe. I could feel my throat closing. Finally made it to the truck. We're driving to the Matsu Regional Hospital at over 100 miles an hour with one of the kids. And as I was driving, the throat continued to close more and more. And as it closed, I thought, well, this is how it ends. What will it be like? Will I panic for my last breath? Or will I just quietly and calmly lay my chair back and accept my fate? Will I stop the truck, open the door, and go lay in the grass? How should I pass? What will this be like? What will my last words be? Oh, wait, I can't talk. How about thoughts? I don't know. We arrive at the hospital. I sprint in to the emergency room, and they stop me at the front desk to fill out paperwork. And I think, oh, great, insurance questions. I should have laid in the grass. I don't want to die doing paperwork. This is miserable. So then I just busted through the ER doors myself, and the last thing I remember there was a tube being jammed down my throat in their attempt to intubate me. I was flown to the Washington Medical Center in Seattle, and once I arrived there, it was only within a short time they discovered that my carotid artery had been damaged and was blocking the blood flow to the right side of my brain. And while it was blocking that blood, it caused a 97% stroke of my right hemisphere. And that stroke, they CAT scanned me, and the doctor said to my mother, we need to take Trevor into emergency surgery right away. And she asked, well, what will happen if you don't? He'll be dead in less than an hour. Well, then go. Takes me in. They remove the right side of my skull to allow my brain to swell. And as they do that, my mother is weeping, certain that my death is imminent. And the doctor comes back in, removes his mask, and says, he made it, he's alive. They set me back in the bed, and I'm still unconscious for the next week. And the doctor says, the doctor, the nurse, these are the things they begin to say. One, the nurse says, Trevor is the most critical patient in the ICU right now. And then the doctor said, we've never seen a stroke this large on a living person. And in fact, if by some anomaly Trevor were to survive this, it is most likely that he will never walk again. What kind of guy was he? Active, mountain climber, scuba diver, skydiver? Well, he most likely will not remember or know you, and you won't know who he is. What we want to know is, are we doing too much to save his life? My parents' response was, if Trevor can have relationship with people, he will want to live. Keep going. So they went on. They started a social media page, and they spread it all over the world. And by the time my story was over, we had nearly, almost exactly, 100,000 hits on that webpage. It spread all over. There was people in our Christian community through the grapevine that were praying all over for my recovery. And miraculously, at the end of that time, the 7 days, I began to slowly wake up. And as I awoke, I began to become aware of the reality of what had happened. I reached over and felt the left side of my body. I was unable to move that left side. In fact, I could not walk, talk, or swallow. Shortly after that, my thoughts began to be, oh, great, I'll never be able to have an IPA at the Moose's Tooth with Landon or Justin, and holidays are going to be horrible. And then I finally, as I'm waking up, my first thought was, oh, that life of abstinence and giving to others, did I miss it? I tell you, I'll never be able to go on a bender in Vegas or the Mardi Gras and enjoy it. I skipped Cancun in college. Man, this was the reality that was setting in with me, and I was beginning to grieve and tears and sorrow of, man, I've lost everything. I missed it. But then the letters came in, poured in from the kids I had worked with. And they said, Trevor, you have no idea how much your life has impacted me. You encouraged me towards God, and it has made all the difference in my life. And we just want you to know how thankful we are for you. And we heard from countries all over the world, unique, some obscure, China, Peru, Sweden, France, even Texas. Yep. In fact, we heard from Swaziland, and forgetting his name, that's great. My friend said to me, he said, Trevor, that's great. My whole life I've been told to pray for Africa. Now Africa is praying for you. And I, after that, was told by my physiatrist, Trevor, I gave you less than a 5% chance to ever move your left limbs again at all, let alone function with them. And I, in the next 4 weeks, walked out of that hospital with a single point cane and saying, I did not miss it, I am in.
That was Trevor Millar, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Just a quick reminder that all the past Arctic Entries stories are available for listening on our website, arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud.
Our next storyteller, Lisa Maloney, loves to dance. In fact, it was a night of dancing that led to this real-life soap opera.
7 years ago, I met a man. It wasn't love at first sight. But once we got started talking, I realized there was actually a lot to like about this guy. He seemed to feel the same way about me, so we started dating. And before you know it, 5 years have zoomed by like nothing, and we are in love. Now, I'm not talking the sort of, you know, woo, this will be fun while it lasts, flash in the pan type of love. I'm talking we were happy to sit together in the same room and just quietly read books, happy that we were breathing the same air. That kind of love. My mom loved him too, by the way, which is really nice. There was one little rub, though, that kept everything from being totally perfect, and that's that he really preferred to hang out at my place more than at his. And it took me a while to find out exactly why that was, but finally he admitted that it was because he was hiding some undocumented people at his place. And he didn't want to get me involved in this. And this might sound a little far-fetched, but I should mention that he was from a country where a lot of undocumented people do come through, so it wasn't actually that far-fetched when you know it in context. And it did bother me, though. I'm like, really? You waited until now to tell me this? Didn't you think, in the interest of disclosure, you should have coughed it up? And I took a little time to decide if I still wanted to be with somebody that was keeping secrets from me like that. But, you know, we'd been together for long enough, and I have some really big trust issues, but I had not only fallen in love with him, I had fallen in trust. And I decided that that was worth something, and that because I knew if he was involved with this, there weren't going to be drugs, there wasn't going to be trafficking, anything like that. It was just one human being helping out some other human beings who were in a really tough spot. I said, okay, I'm going to take a big chance on you, buddy. Everything goes pretty smoothly again. You know, he's upfront, he's honest, it's great. Still trust him. Until one day I fall down the very strange rabbit hole that is comments on an online Alaska Dispatch news article. It's a strange place to be. But I wander in there when I should be working instead. And the article is about a car accident. And one of the commenters had actually gone to the trouble of looking up the driver in the car accident on CourtView. And then he came back to comment. He's like, no, that guy should not have been allowed to drive because he has all these terrible convictions. All right. So that makes me curious. So I successfully evade a few more minutes of work by going into CourtView myself. You know, it's the public record system. Anybody can look up anybody. And I look up this guy, and sure enough, he's in there. And it's like, whoa, that's some pretty nasty stuff. Maybe he shouldn't have been driving. But as long as I'm in there, exactly. You see where this is going. So the love of my life, let's call him Freddie, just to give him a name. And I had actually looked Freddie up before when it was obvious that we were first getting serious. You know, it's not stalking if you're just checking to make sure that he wasn't accused of being a stalker. And he hadn't been. There were no crimes, just some little speeding tickets, things like that. It's like, okay, I can deal with that. But I'm in there, I'm like, well, maybe he's got new tickets or something. I should check it out and I can tease him afterward. And I make a typo. I get one letter wrong. So instead of the speeding tickets that I was expecting, up pops this case that's totally different. Almost the same name, very common name, exactly the same birth date. And I look at it, and I'm pretty sure part of me was just like, nope, don't want to see that. So I go back to work. I'm like, whoa, biggest coincidence in the world. Who knew? And a little while later, he goes out of town to visit family, and I take him to the airport and, you know, hug, hug, kiss, kiss. Okay, bye, sweetheart, have fun. And I'm having a great time having a few days to myself, but that thing I saw in CourtView just kind of keeps nibbling at the back of my mind. So I decide, all right, the only way I'm going to put this to rest is if I go down to the courthouse, and again, public records, not stalkery at all. I'm going to pull that case. I'm going to see that it really is a crazy coincidence. It doesn't have anything at all to do with him. And then it'll be great. And he's coming back the next day, so I can just meet him with a big hug and everything will be fine. So I go down to the domestic violence counter in the courthouse. And I say to the woman there, I couldn't believe that I found myself saying this, but it was okay because everything was going to be fine as soon as I saw that it wasn't him. I said, I think my boyfriend might be lying to me, and I'm just here to look at the case so I can see that he's not. She doesn't even bat an eye, and I realize that this is not the first time that she has heard this. Sorry. She goes and she gets the folder, and she brings it back, and I open it up, and I start turning pages. And pretty soon, I am embroiled in this real-life soap opera of a man and a woman, and they're married, and they have kids, and the woman has been hitting one of the kids, and the man takes out a restraining order against her on behalf of the kid. And it's a big hot mess, but it's a handwritten hot mess. Somebody wrote this out all by hand, and I can see that it is not Freddie's handwriting. So I'm like, wow, that really was a coincidence. Who knew? I am so off the hook. But by this point, I'm also kind of invested in these people in the paper. And I want to know what happens. So I keep turning the pages and reading, but I haven't said anything to the clerk yet because I don't want her to think that I am some kind of creep that just reads other people's restraining orders for fun. And so I'm getting to the end, and they're actually working things out, and I'm kind of happy for these people that I don't know at all. You know, she got counseling, it's all going to be okay. And then at the very last page, I see it. It's his signature. Somebody else had written down the story, and then Freddie had signed it. It's a very unmistakable signature. There's no way I could be wrong. And I just looked up at the woman. I said, it is him. I don't know how I got home. Obviously, I did. At some point, I managed to get in my car and drive myself home. And I just remember laying there in bed thinking, what do you do when you took a chance on somebody, when you went all in, and you find out that not only was he lying to you, but he was actively duping you the entire time, making you think he was somebody he wasn't. There's no script for that. But the next day, he was coming in from the airport, and I had his car at my place, so there was no way we were going to miss each other. Well, the next day, I get out of bed, I go to the airport, and when his plane comes in, I'm standing there waiting. I give him a great big hug, because I know it's the last one that we're ever going to have. I asked him how his trip went, and I listened to his story as we walked down to my car in the parking garage. And when he gets in, there's a copy of the papers from the court sitting on his chair. And he picks it up and he looks at it and he just stares. And I said, "Is there anything you want to tell me?" He said, "I'm still hoping this could be saved somehow." And he finally says, "Yeah, okay. I'm married. I have two kids." There's another long pause. "I mean, what do you say to that? I had nothing." And then he says, "Just take me back to my car and I'll vanish from your life forever. You'll never see me again." It's the wrong thing to say to somebody that you have been actively duping for 5 years. So I said, "No, we're not going to do that." You know what we did instead? We went to his wife's house. Because he had been passing off his buddy's house as his own all this time, but I had the address from the paperwork. I knew where they really lived. So I took him there. I kicked his sorry ass out on the porch at 1 a.m. with his little suitcase, and I drove off. Thanks.
That was Lisa Maloney on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Our theme for this show is Grapevine, stories of rumors, pranks, and scandals.
Next up, Pat Lampe, who has worked at the Alaska Zoo for 30 years. This is the same story he told at the Bear Stories event at the International Bear Association Conference. You guessed it, his story is about a bear.
It was April of 2000, and I got a call really early in the morning. Some of the staff that had been at the zoo had saw an intruder. Not your usual intruder. This was a four-legged intruder. Usually what we worry about is something getting out, not getting in. What they saw was a subadult brown bear, about 300 pounds, in the zoo grounds and hanging out by our adult brown bear. Well, as soon as he saw the people, he went back out. And what he had done is he dug under the fence where it spans the creek. Even though there were metal rods pounded into the ground, the creek beds are pretty soft, and he dug around them. Well, we thought, you know, we'll go back. He went right out, so pounded in more rods deeper, and we thought that was going to be the end of it, but that wasn't the case. He kept coming back. Each time, he would tunnel in the same area, just off to the side a little bit, and he'd hang around our big male Kodiak bear, and that's the only place he was going. So we got a hold of Rick Sinnott with Alaska Department of Fish and Game and told him our story, you know, what was going on. He said, "Oh, yeah, we know all about this bear. He's been in trouble in the neighborhood. He's been getting into trash cans, up on people's decks. He's got some sense because we put in a culvert trap and he wouldn't go into it." And he said, "So we got to come up with another plan." Well, I said, "You know, he's a subadult. I think I can find a home for him. And, you know, rather than destroy the bear, how about if we go that way?" And Rick said, "Okay, this is what we'll try. If he breaks in again," then he goes, "you call me. I will go set up just outside the perimeter fence, and then I'll have you go try to dart him inside the zoo. And if he tries to come out, I'll dart him." So that was a plan, but the next day he didn't show up. But 2 days later, I came into work early. My phone was ringing. I pick it up. It was a reporter. They had heard about it. And they're asking, "So is the bear there?" And I go, "I don't know. I just got here. And I have no idea." And they said, "Call me when he's there." And I go, "Of course I will. That'll be the first thing I'll do." So I went down there. Sure enough, the bear is there. He's lying right outside the bars by Big Jake. So I go back to my office. I call Rick, and he goes, "Hey, the neighbors already called me. I am good to go. So you go after him." So I called the rest of the staff. The zoo wasn't to open for another couple hours, so we positioned staff in areas of the zoo, and then I went down there with a dart gun and had a guy with me with a gun for backup, of course. Well, he had moved from the front to the back part in the narrow corridor between the bear bars and the perimeter fence. Luckily, off to the west, there was a patch of woods that we could approach through. So we sneak up through the woods, and dart guns aren't meant for really long distance, so ideally you get, you know, by maybe 30 yards or less, and we actually got close enough about that distance. Bears, you want to shoot them in the neck or the shoulder. They've got a nice big target on their big butts, but there's too much fat, so it takes too long for the drugs to take effect. And we use a nice little cocktail, ketamine, xylazine, and romp them, and it's a nice little bear cocktail. So anyway, you shoot for the neck, and it usually takes about 15 minutes for a bear to go down. So we get in position, and I'm just ready to take the shot, and I notice, well, there's a little teeny tiny willow branch, you know, just by the bear. And I thought, well, I'll never hit that. You know, no way, not even if I tried, you know. Of course, Murphy would have given better odds. So anyway, I take the shot. I don't know if I twitched or a little breeze blew the branch, but I hit that branch dead center. Smacks the bear, and off he goes. Across the top, down the side, out deep into the zoo. Of course, I get on the radio, load up another dart, let people know he's coming. Well, they scare him back, and he comes back. He went right back to the exact same spot. So I sneak back up there, got a little closer. That willow branch totally immobilized. It wasn't going anywhere. Dart was still in it. So I take another shot. This time I got him in the neck, and I must have hit a vein because he went across the top, down the side, and I mean less than a minute, he was completely out. Jake walks up, the big brown bear walks up between the bars and starts pushing on him like, hey, you okay, buddy? You know, hey, you know, hey. And he didn't move. So luckily we were able to recall Jake into the den so we could go out and go, are you really out? Are you really out? Because we had to go all the way around, get a big backboard, roll him onto it, about 300, 350 pounds, strap him down, carry him down the hill, cross the creek, under the bridge, and go put him in an old den until we could do a transport. Well, didn't have long to take to train him, so what I did was every day I would put a little trail of Fig Newton cookies leading into the shipping crate so he could go in, and every day he went a little further, and then the last day, I put a little trail in with a big jackpot of cookies at the end. He went in, I dropped the door, he was trapped. What he didn't know, some of them were laced with Valium. So he went there, got shipped out, made it down to his new home in Duluth, Minnesota really well. You know, made it all the way, made a little bit of noise on the plane when he started coming out because there was also 10,000 pounds of fish in the hold of that plane. So he made a little noise, and the pilot made an announcement and told the people, don't worry, the cage is strong, it's all right. But he made it fine, and he was actually accepted. They had an older female bear named Phoebe who had never accepted another bear as a exhibit mate, but she did accept Trouble. That's what we named him. And so I guess Phoebe was a little bit of a cougar, too, maybe. All right. I'll never miss Trouble, but I'll never forget him. Thank you.
That was the Alaska Zoo's Pat Lampe, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Longtime Alaskan Christy Morgan will help us close out this hour with a story from her good old college days at UAF. And what's a good college story without a prank?
21 short-seeming years ago, I was a sophomore at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I thought I had a few things figured out by this point in my life. I was this close to picking a major, and I had a solid group of friends, Amy, Erica, Kira, Glenna, Robin, Jack, and others, who never left me with a dull moment. My buddy Jack was gifted with a roommate named Kevin, and they lived just up the hill, close to my dorm. So I spent a lot of time at their place because they were always up to something interesting, like watching Star Wars for the millionth time, or turning a pickle into a nightlight. This happened. I still don't know how. But they were always, you know, they're fun to be around. And so as I hung out there more, I got to know Kevin, and it very quickly was clear to me that I really liked him. He was a cool guy. He was cool like music I had never heard before, like dyeing your hair with Kool-Aid, like spending every Sunday having lunch with your family, like going on borderline illegal adventures with your buddy. He was that kind of cool. And I was just so intrigued by his uniqueness and his sense of humor. And he was kind of quirky. He drove around in what I call a Fairbanks fantastic vehicle. Basically, it looks like but when it's 50 below, it starts right up like that, and that's important. So he only really had one thing in his vehicle that I remember, and it was this round red dot, a plush dot, with big bulky sunglasses and these kind of wobbly arms and legs and white high tops. You may remember it from the mid-90s advertising that 7-Up did, the 7-Up dot. So he had a plush version of this like stuck on the inside windshield of his truck. I thought that's a strange thing to have, but you're really cute, so whatever. So I'm telling my friends, Amy, Erica, Kara, Glenna, Robin, and others, how I feel about Kevin. And they're like, yes, great, tell him. And I was like, no way. I'm going to show him because I'm a sophomore and I have things figured out right now. So I was feeling my power and I was like, I really want to play a prank on him because that will clearly bring me to his attention as more than a friend. I feel sure of this. And it's funny for many reasons, mostly because I have never been a pranky person. I'm way more comfortable in like the verbal smartass zone of life, and that's where I tend to stay. But this prank was bubbling up in me, and so I had to go for it. And it was very simple. One, steal the dot from Kevin's truck. Two, take the dot on a hostage photo tour of town and get the photographs to Kevin. Three, sit back and watch a love blossom, y'all, because that was gonna do it. That was gonna do it. I was sure. So my friends are like, yeah, okay. go. And right off the bat, I'm telling you, it was like the universe was on my side. That Fairbanks fantastic truck also had another lovely feature. The locks didn't work, like at all, which is why he didn't carry much in the truck, except the dot, because who's gonna take that? This girl. This girl's gonna take that. So that was really easy. Mid-90s also, lots of folks brought Polaroid cameras to college. So that was helpful when I was trying to get quick and fast photographs. And then it was just a matter of planning like these elaborate, kind of harrowing yet humorous picture tropes to show that I clearly was a cool and interesting person as well. And the thing about this is this is where the prank took off, and it surprised me because everyone I told about it was like, that is badass. I want to help you. My RA, the resident advisor, was like, well, maybe I could hang it out a window on the top, you know, where no one's supposed to go. Other people volunteered to like menace it in the Lola Tilly Commons with cutlery. We got some great photos. The fry cook of the northernmost Denny's in the world dangled the dot over a vat of boiling oil and let us take not one, but two photographs because he's like, you need to get it right. This needs to tell a story. And he was right, and it did. So I had no problem getting these photographs to Jack and Kevin's house because I was there all the time. So I just kind of hide them a little out of the way, and eventually Kevin would find like a picture of the dot like being harassed with a butter knife or something, and he's like, what the hell? Where are these pictures coming from? He had no idea it was me. So that was great, but in the meantime, I'm starting to kind of sweat it out of it because I don't have like a dismount from this prank. Like, none, not one, not even a bit. And so eventually I realized like, I'm just gonna have to kind of give this in, like, it's over. So I write a very thoughtful ransom note using the Daily News Miner, cut it out, put it together. I never got paid, but eventually I kind of had to, like, give the dot back to Kevin and be like, it was me. And he was very surprised, and we didn't start dating right away, and I was very surprised. But time went by, and, you know, the months rolled along, and we were kind of sliding into spring, the end of the school year. And I remember one night in April, maybe early May. It was very cold, so it's hard to tell. Kevin had walked me home from a party pretty late or early. And right outside my dorm, he reached in to give me a hug. And then he didn't let go, so I didn't let go. And he kept not letting go. And we hugged outside the Moore Bartlett Scarlin complex for 4 hours. And we talked in the chill of an early Fairbanks morning. And you know, after that, we dated for like 3.5 years. And our relationship didn't last. We had ups and downs, we had adventures, we had hard times, but I still consider it one of the best relationships I've ever had in my life, which is kind of funny when you consider how it started, which I consider it starting with my badass prank. So, you know, the other thing I love about this prank 21 years later is it brings to mind people I would not think of otherwise. The fry cook, some friends who have kind of fallen off the radar, and I think about people that I am still friends with 21 years later. I think about people that I'll never talk to again. One of my friends recently passed away, and she was part of this story. And so this is where the other part of the magic of this prank comes in for me, because it brings people forward to my mind now, but it also pulls me back to when I was with them, and they wove in and out of my life on the daily, and it was wonderful. So I am not here to advocate that someone pull off a prank that involves petty theft and like just a little bit of extortion in order to go after a new relationship. But I'm pretty damn happy with how it worked out for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Christy Morgan. That's all for this show.
To hear these stories again, or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way.
The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our site.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo, and thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our lives or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come, and I love your lips, what I get me some. Will we fuss and fight when things go wrong? Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what movie we'll be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiries calling out me. No more reassuring. Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word? Would I have resolve? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who could ask for more? This year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love, or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what movie we'll be. We can swim on.